Father, we thank you so much. We can never thank you enough, but we want to lift our hearts in thanks today, right now, for your incredible, aggressive grace, your aggressive kindness, your just constant gentleness with our lives, your encouragement, the intimacy with you, you offer through the cross, forgiveness of sins, the freedom that that gives us to approach you with every little thing, every big thing in our life. We can never thank you enough for just the outpouring of your goodness in history through your Son, through your prophets, through your Word, and just this sweet song of redemption and closeness with you. Bless our time here as we look into your Word, that we might draw closer to you, we might honor your Son more, that we might have more confidence in him and open more of our lives up to him and fall more and more in love with him. We ask this and your blessings upon these sweet people here today as we look into your Word. For your Son's sake, amen. Okay, we actually have a handout. Today we're on Psalm 2. So we're going to look at Psalm 1, of course, was the introductory to the Psalms. There are 150 Psalms. And Psalm 1 is the one that it tells us about a lifestyle, about being planted by the rivers of water and about growing from the nurture of who we are, where we are with the Lord, and enjoying that time of life and with the Lord. Psalm 2, we change gears, and Psalm 2 is the most quoted psalm in the New Testament. So of all the psalms, and there are a lot of cases of the psalms being quoted and cited and alluded to and all that kind of stuff in the New Testament, but Psalm 2 is the one that has the most number of quotes, and you'll see exactly why. And it's sort of odd as to why this is number two in the Psalter, because it's a little odd once you look at it. Now, what you've got there on your front page is the Hebrew. I assume Nap's already taught most of you Hebrew, right? The Old Testament. Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to presume about that. We're going to just go switch over to the Hebrew language. But what I wanted to do here was to show you. I'm just going to go through the sections to show you how to get as close as we can to the original. So you'll see some of the emphasis before we switch over to the pure English. So on the sheets that you've got, they're identical to what I have. What you'll see there is Hebrew reads from right to left. And that's the first thing I'll throw you out. So that's why the numbers are over on the far right. No, I'm not holding the foil upside down, you know, backwards. It actually reads from right to left. Modern Hebrew, ancient Hebrew, most of the ancient Semitic languages read from right to left. And so what you've got there on this particular verse 1 is you've got the Hebrew as it shows up in the Hebrew Bible. Then you've got it broken down a little bit into its parts for us little student types. And then you've got it those little parts translated into English. And then the last one is the line where it's put together into the way it's sort of translated in English translations, okay? And the main thing about Hebrew poetry, this is poetry, the Psalms are poetry. It's got lyrical flow with it, and it matches, and it's got all kind of balance and parallel, like you would have in English rhyming and stuff of this type. Word order is important a little, and so that there's a couple of little things that God is trying to really emphasize here that you wouldn't necessarily see in English, and that's what I wanted to draw our attention to as we just go through this. So I'm going to mostly be working with the bottom line there, so you'll see. So Psalm 2 starts out with, to what or why or for what purpose or what's this all about kind of word, to what purpose conspire the nations. And the nations is the word goyim, the nations. What are they conspiring about? I mean, why are they conspiring? There's no point to it is what the to what is about. To what point are they conspiring? And the people, the countries, they plot in vain, an emptiness. So vanity of vanities, this is that word emptiness. They're plotting. They're doing something. The nations are plotting, and the people, they're plotting. But it's totally empty, whatever they're plotting. And then verse 2 says how this plotting is looking. Well, they set themselves, which means they take a stand. So it's like a public statement. This group would have made a press announcement. They would have had a ribbon cutting or something like this in front of the media. Have set themselves the kings of the earth. And king is Melechi, the word for king, like we get in Melchizedek. king of righteousness, which no doubt Neb's taken you through there. Kings of the earth and the rulers, they conspire together. So we have, and the word conspire there actually, it means growl. So it's like they're in the dark and they're growling about this conspiracy. They're whining and complaining and growling and unhappy about whatever it is they're plotting against. And then we find out in the second half of verse 2, the target of their plot. Move it up. They're plotting against Yahweh. So there's that tetragram and the four letters, W-H-Y-H, Yahweh, against the Lord, okay, and against his anointed one. And there's the word Meshach, that we get the word Messiah from. So the Hebrew word for the anointed one was Meshach. So when you hear a Jews for Jesus or somebody talking about Jesus the Messiah, so you will hear them talk about Yeshua HaMashiach. Yeshua, Jesus, HaMashiach, the Messiah. Ha is the in front of it, HaMashiach. So these rulers, for some reason, they're plotting empty. I mean, it's just senseless what they're doing. But the psalmist is describing this as they're plotting, and the people that who they're plotting against is both God and some anointed figure, God's anointed, his Messiah, his now their anointing, of course, applied to a number of people in the Old Testament. So kings were anointed, prophets were anointed, priests were anointed. The Aaronic priests were all anointed when they took office. Okay, those three official titles were anointed. So we don't know yet whether his anointed is a Messiah like a king yet. It hasn't been stated yet. Okay, but it's against somebody that God has designated for service, right? Because that's what he anoints them for, is for service. So then we move to the third verse in that first part. And this is the content of their plot. Here's what they're saying when they're groaning. They're saying, we're going to break their bonds, the bonds of God and his anointed. Let us cast from us their cords, okay, or their fetters, however you can translate that. So what we've got are these people that are apparently are already under the authority of God and the anointed, because they say we've got chains on us, we've got fetters on us, we've got bonds on us holding us into the harness or something like this, and say we're going to throw these off, okay? And so the anointed here looks like it's already like a King David or a king that's got, you know, some kind of authority over countries around them. But their first complaint is they said, we're going to gather together, we're going to overthrow, we're going to revolt, we're going to rebel against God, and God designate that's the anointed one on earth, and we're going to not serve them anymore. We're going to rebel, we're going to declare our independence. So we're no longer, in the case of nationalities or geography, we're no longer going to pay taxes. But the downside of this is we can't anymore call them when the enemies are attacking us either. I mean, that's what the vassal states, the subject states, got out of the deal in many cases. They got protection by the Lord and his anointed when Assyria or Babylon would come if they were, you know, they were aligned with God and his anointed. But these folk in the back room, as it were, growling, they're plotting. They haven't gotten around to doing anything yet. They're just talking. In other words, they haven't got to implementation yet. They're still in planning stage. They're still in brainstorming. We're going to do this. We're going to throw it off. We're going to rebel. So that's the first part. There's four parts to the Psalms. That's the first one. The first one, the psalmist draws this picture of these folk, the nations. And it's the leaders. It's not actually the people in the kingdom. See, it's just the little rulers. You know, they're the ones that, you know, apparently they're the ones that are having the biggest problem with being submissive to the Lord. Common folk, most of us common folk, we could care less. You know, as long as we got peace and things are going well, we can raise our family. You know, I really don't care a whole lot about, you know, political fighting up there and who gets voted and stuff like that. It's when it comes down and starts hurting me and my kids and, you know, my job and my ability to take care of my responsibilities, that it gets tricky. But here the rulers are just, maybe it's a status, maybe it's pride, maybe it's a arrogance. I mean, we're familiar with all of those things. So it may very well be something of that type, right? And then we have a picture, the psalmist backs up and he looks up at what's going on in heaven. They're down here talking and grumbling, groaning, growling. And up in the top, up in heaven, we have he who is sitting in the heaven. So that's an image of somebody sitting on the throne. not just sitting on a little ottoman of some type. He's sitting on the throne. It's a royal image. He who sits in the heavens, that'd be God, he laughs. He's laughing at this. It's just almost silly down there. And my Lord mocks them or scoffs at them. This is the same word as scoffing in Psalms 1. I will not hang out with the scoffers, right? Those that scoff at God. And this word Lord is the word Adonai. I'm sure you've been over it a gazillion times, and that in the Old Testament, when you see the all caps for Lord, what word is it? Yahweh. When Lord is spelled in all caps, it's Yahweh. When the word God, or all caps in G too, when you've got God with capital G, lowercase O and D, it's the word Elohim, which is the title for God. So foreign gods that are not really gods are called Elohim in the Old Testament. So you'll see when you have a battle of the battle of the gods with Elijah on Mount Carmel, when he's fighting Baal, Baal is called a god. You know, call upon your god. Maybe he's gone to sleep. You know, maybe he's out trying to get some breakfast together. You know, Elijah taunts them. And he uses the Elohim. And then when you have a capital L, lowercase O-R-D, or a lowercase L-O-R-D, that is the word Adonai, which just means master. It was a polite term of respect. So when Sarah called Abraham Lord, she just called him master. And when Abraham would call Pharaoh Adonai Lord, it's just a term of respect, because they would, you would say that, you would go back. You would go back and forth. You would reciprocate. So here, whoever's writing this says, my Lord, my master, who is this apparently God in heaven. So whoever's writing this is a believer that's trying to serve the Lord, writes and says, God mocks them from the heavens. So he laughs, then he mocks, scoffs, and then he will speak. So then he says, but after the laughing and after the scoffing, once he's been sort of amused at this, the pettiness of these people, and at that point, he realizes that something sort of may have to be done, because they're about to create trouble for the little people that live in their kingdoms, the little glens of the world. You know, they may go to war against God and his Messiah. And guess who's going to be in trouble there real quickly? Me. Okay? So the word then says that at some point, God says, I'm going to intervene here. I've been gracious. I've been patient. You know, I've sent prophets. I've tried to give them time to, you know, wake up, come to their senses, but they're not making any progress, so it looks like I'm going to have to actually do something. So then he will speak to them in his wrath. And his wrath is not, we would call this in the New Testament days, this is a chastening wrath and not a punishment wrath. In other words, there's a word in Hebrew called nakam that's normally the word for wrath. And nakam is a wrath when the ruler finally passes judgment and says, all eyes are upon me. This is not corrective. This is now punitive. I have to go uphold law. I am going to nakam. I am going to express my wrath. So the wrath at the day of the Lord, for example, okay, final day of the Lord, is a nakam wrath. It's not a chastening wrath. And this is just the word for an emotional sort of chastening wrath. I am going to deal with them. You know, it's folly. I still care for them. You know, because we're going to later, he's going to later says, come on in and rejoice. You know, just get your head on straight and then come on and rejoice with us at the coronation. So it's not like a huge enemies issue. It's a wrath. I'm upset. I'm going to have to go deal with this. So in his wrath and in his fury, and he will terrify them. In other words, it's just that same way that when I remember as a kid, my mother every year at Christmas in the stockings when we were little gave us those little bolos, those little rubber balls on the string with the little paddle that you're supposed to do this in. She knew that none of us could do this, of the three children, three sons. None of us had enough hand-eye coordination to do this. And so the rubber band and would break the first day, and then what we had were ready-made paddles for spanking. And so when we knew we were about to get in trouble and she dropped her voice an octave, Glenn, you know, or called me by my last name, Mr. Miller, you know, then I knew that I was getting there. And that's what I would get terrified, because I was aware that in my groanings and plots to overthrow her authority or whatever, that I had been caught. And so it was a legitimate response that when authority would speak in anger and says, okay, it's time for a woodshed activity, time for that trip to the woodshed, I would be legitimately terrified. Okay, and that's what the image is about here in the first two verses of that part. And then the last verse in the second part is where he says, okay, I'm going to speak to you, and let me be really clear about where this is. You can plot your rebellion all you want, but let me just restate reality. And I have set. Now, this is an emphasis thing. Normally, you wouldn't have this word over here. You wouldn't normally say I twice, because the verb already has got the word I in it. Some languages have it set up that way to where it's already in, like yo soy in Spanish. Soy already says I in it. It's already got the word I in it. You don't need it twice, okay, strictly speaking. You know, and a lot of languages are that way, that's already got I built in it. So you don't need I unless you're trying to make a real point. And you say, I, comma, I will speak. I will do. Okay? And that's what you've got here, is that in the front of that sentence, before you've got I have set my king, you've got I. But I am the one who set this. So let's not dispute. This is not a human you're fighting against, nations. Okay? This is me, God. Okay? And I have appointed, I have set my king. There's that Melchi again. Melchizedek. I have set my king, it's got the little ending for my, on Zion, the mountain of my holiness. Now, Zion is one of the hills of Jerusalem. There are a number of hills that make up the city of Jerusalem, but Zion is one of them, and it came to mean, you know, for the whole city, okay? So I have set my king on the mountain of holiness. So let's be really clear, he says, okay, I know you, the first one, the picture was you're plotting. I've got, secondly, let's be really clear about this. I'm in charge here, and I have set my king, my anointed, and now we know that the anointed is the king. Right? Remember the first one we just said, they rail against the anointed? Now we know that the anointed is now a king, and it is someone ruling from Jerusalem. Alright, so that's our second. The first one was the psalmist was looking over at the conspirators in the back room, talking big about what they were gonna do, complaining about God's chains and fetters, which is totally ridiculous. That's a separate problem. We'll talk about that. The second part was what we just looked at here. God's response. We're looking up in heaven. We're seeing what God is doing, saying, and he announces, I've already set my king on the hill there. And then the next speaker is the king. So the next speaker is that the anointed one, the Meshach, the king, is the next one. Speaks, and he starts off by saying, I will proclaim, okay, I will set forth. It's actually the word write, sefer. I will actually write. The soferim were the scribes. So I will actually write or announce a written decree is what this is. I will announce that God has, God is so serious about this, he made it an official document. Okay, I will announce the decree of the Lord. And he said, the Lord said to me, that's the me, he said to me, my son are you, that's put together. Sometimes, again, for emphasis, they would leave out the verb. So this basically says, son, you. Or we would say, today, hot. You know, we would leave out, just for emphasis, we'd say, today is hot. We'd say, today, hot. Okay? And this says, son, you. My son, you. Okay? You are my son. Very emphatic that the Yahweh says, you are my son. Okay? And that's the word in Hebrew, that's the word ben. Ben means son, like in Ben-Hur, the son of Hur. Okay? Because they're going to use a different word for ben in a few minutes, for son in a minute. Okay. Right now we've got, you are my son. This day I have begotten you. Now notice again, we've got that I repeated. See, we didn't have to have that pronoun in there, but it's there. Okay? I, this day, have begotten you. You are my son. I have begotten you today. Today is coronation day. Okay? Wasn't the day David was born. Okay? But the day that he set him up as king and he made that Davidic covenant promise in 2 Samuel 7. When he said, I will build a house for you. This day I've made you my son. And he makes the Davidic covenant to create the line that eventually leads to the Messiah. Okay? So here is the Lord that says, you are my son. This is quoted any number of times in the New Testament, of course, several times. And let me digress here for just a moment, talk about sonship. In the Jesus is called the Son of God several different times in the New Testament. One is at the Annunciation before he's born. So when angel Gabriel appears to Mary, he gives out the pronouncement. He said, therefore, the Holy Spirit shall come upon you and overpower you. Therefore, the holy thing that shall be born of you shall be called the Son of God. Okay. Directly, direct intervention of God. And that sonship has nothing to do with this one. Sort of. Okay. Sort of. It's direct creation of a ruler of Israel. So it's sort of to do with it. The next time he's called the Son of God, he refers to God as his father a couple of times in between the two events. But eventually the next one is when he's baptized by John the Baptist, his relative. John the Baptist goes out, Jesus goes in, baptizes. When he comes out, the heavens open, the Father says, this is my Son whom I love. Okay? So there's annunciation. It was for the sake of John the Baptist. John the Baptist said, this is why I came baptizing in water, so that God, so it would be made known to me who the Messiah was. That's how God revealed it to John the Baptist, who then became the evangelist for Jesus. Okay? So he's called the Son of God there by a voice from heaven, a bat kol in Hebrew. Then at the Transfiguration, we have another one. So a couple of months before the crucifixion, he goes up on the mountain of Transfiguration. Peter, James, and John are getting up there. They fall asleep. Nap time, I guess. They carried their blankies. I don't know why they were always falling asleep, but they fall asleep. He's enveloped by a cloud. Elijah and Moses are there. They're discussing his death. The Greek word is exodus. His exodus from the earth to set us free. Captive, beautiful image of redemption. They're discussing this, and then when Peter, James, and John wake up, the voice appears out of the cloud and says, this is my beloved son, and then he says, listen to him. Pay attention, you know. And I always wonder, you know, as thick as I am, whether God was thinking, you know, I should have said this when he was baptized. If I told him to listen earlier, maybe they would. I'm guilty, Lord. I swear. I know. I'm there, all over it. I'm all over it there. And then the next time he's called the Son of God will be in the New Testament after the resurrection, and Paul will say he was declared to be the Son of God in power. Not just the Son of God, but the Son of God in power by the resurrection from the dead. And we will see that that was actually when he's instated into his official position as ruler of the entire universe. Okay? But what he hasn't done so far is this next verse. So the Messiah, the King, is describing what God has said to him. Today I have begotten you, you are my son, I am your father. Ask from me, and I will make the nations your heritage, and your possession, the ends of the earth. In other words, when he first puts him on his throne, he's only the king of Israel. He's not monarch over all the universe, or the rest of the world. Okay? He has to ask. Now, the king always has to ask anytime from God. A true divine king of the Lord had to always ask, Lord, give us victory in battle. Lord, give us relief from the plague. Lord, give us food for the harvest. You know, they always were they were asking for wisdom to judge like Solomon, and God would ask, what do you want? So when in the Solomon's dream, God appeared to Solomon. He says, ask what you will. See, it was the king was supposed to ask for things, and the Messiah here is not challenged, but offered everything from this. The book of Hebrews lets us know that not everything has been put under his feet yet. See? That he hasn't asked yet for this. That's the second coming. The day is going to come when he's through building his bride, when he's through calling out people, when the patience that's described in Peter, you know, the long suffering, not God is not willing that any should perish. Judgment's not slow. It's just God just loves, doesn't hate. He hates judgment. He hates doing judgment. He just wants to get everybody in out of the rain and the cold as much as possible. And that's why it's delayed. Not because God's slow or lazy or something like this. But the day will come where the more bad is being done than good in terms of overall health of everything, and it will be enough is enough, and I got to do the NACOM type of wrath now, and we have the second coming. And the sun will get up and say, now's the time. I have to go back and rebuild this. And so this is what the Father has said to the Son in this particular passage. And to assure him that it wouldn't be a bad thing if he got all the nations, that as bad as the nations are, and that's the word there is goyim, which is Gentiles. That's us broken down wild olive branches of Romans 9 through 11. Okay, that's us. As bad as we are, we're not going to mess up the apple cart because he can rule us with a rod of iron. And like a potter, you can shatter them. In other words, we're not that difficult to deal with. We're not that big of a threat. We may whine and complain and groan and stuff like that, but there's enough power on the part of God to deal with us, even when we're together in groups. I remember I had a professor at Dallas Seminary, and it was so funny. We looked at one of the passages, one of the stories that Jesus told about says, and all I remember is from is the King James Monetary Unit says, he says in one version of the parable, he says, are not two sparrows sold for a farthing, to use the King James, two sparrows sold for a farthing. And then in another passage when he tells a story, five sparrows sold for two farthings. And the wise theology professor, in other words, we're worth less the more of us that are together in the group. You know, he says, although we're worth a little bit more, but we compound things when we get together. We just do these things like the nations do or something of that type. So then we move to the final section. So the first section was we had the picture of the nations that were in uproar. The second one we had the scene from heaven. God says, what? I've already said this. Let me remind you very clearly. I have my set up my king here, my anointed here. The third one is from the anointed king saying, I have this relationship. I'm supposed to fulfill my father's will. I am the vice regent now. You know, I'm begotten. I have the power for this. And that's what this is about. And then we come to the final section, which is grace. This shows you what this is. This is not about trying to kill the wicked, you know. This is about trying to get everybody back into the warmth, back into the warmth. At the end of the day, the psalmist then comes back and starts reflecting upon this and says, so then. In other words, that's that old therefore. That would be therefore. And remember, as Nap would no doubt have taught you like he did me, when you see a therefore, you ask what it's there for. Right? And the therefore is the conclusion here. For our kings, Melech, be wise. Mashal, the word for Proverbs. Okay, Mashal is the word for Proverbs. Riddles. Be wise. Think about these things. Reflect upon this. Be honest. Be truthful. Just face reality here. Be wise. Be warned, rulers of the earth. Okay? In other words, you people that are in authority and in power, pay attention. Just be warned. Learn from the mistakes. Learn from the confrontation. God hasn't hurt you yet. He just warned you, shook you up a little bit to show you where the boundaries are. Hasn't done anything yet. So there's still grace here. Come on in. Come on in. Be wise. Serve the Lord with fear. This is what every individual is supposed to do. This is not obedience. This is not where I'm going to pay lip service. You know, this is serving with respect that he's due, that he's worth. And then look at this next verb, rejoice. Galah. Every celebration is called a galah. Okay? And rejoice with trembling. And they're not called to move from grumbling and groaning to being quiet and sullen. They're called to move from being groaning to actually rejoicing and thinking, what was I doing over there? That was stupid. I could have been over here rejoicing in the celebration all this time. And there I was over here. What? It was I thinking. Right? Who doesn't live there every day of your Christian life? So what was I thinking over there? rejoice with trembling. That the coronation. Why would you rejoice if I'm a nation in the ancient Near East, let's say, that God is in control, God is in reign, and he put the king in an earthly sphere? Why in the world would that cause rejoicing for me? One, because that means my wars are over. I don't have to fight anymore. Because to the extent when everybody knows that that's a reality, then I ain't got to worry about people on the other side of me attacking me. I can actually invest less money in the locks on my door. And I can buy pears and grapes. And I can buy more G.I. Joe toys for my kids or whatever. Right? I can invest less in protecting myself and more in enjoying the safety of the Messianic King, the Messianic ruler. Okay? Plenty of reasons to rejoice in such a justice and a fairness, somebody that can seize the truth of political intrigue, etc. Then 12, they say, okay, be warned, be wise, wise up here, serve the Lord, rejoice. Come on over here into the sunshine, into the warmth, into the good place. Kiss the sun, which is a homage image. Kiss the sun. So he does not be angry. And again, it's not the nakam word. The anger is just, it's just one of those, you know, the parent kind of word. It's not a harsh judgment or irreversible vengeance word. Lest you perish in the way that you're walking, because burns like a little his anger. Now, I got to talk about this. The way this works, the anger, because in the English, you'll see, because his anger can flare up in a moment, is how it's translated generally. It's just his anger has a quick, explosive character to it, right? And the point here is that the anger has not manifested itself. It's been there. You know, whenever we start doing something wrong down here, God gets upset with it. He gets grieved. He gets upset with it, because especially when it hurts somebody else. But he errs on the side of patience and grace and goodness. So he lets it go as long as he sort of can before he has to intervene and cut the thing short, right? But at some point, it's going to explode. We're going to cross some break-even point, you know, some trade-off point, and it's going to look like it just popped up out of nowhere, that it was whimsical, when it was growing all along, but it was being held back by restraint, by God's patience and his gentleness with us. But when it comes, it comes. Okay? When it comes, and it comes quickly. Okay, so he says, be warned and pay homage, respect. Just, in other words, be honest about the way things are. I mean, that's the problem, is that we try to be gods, and we set up our own universe. We write our own little Bibles. And, you know, we try to do this, and that's our problem. It's just that if we could just get back more honesty, just to see things the way they really are, God, life would be a whole lot simpler, And then that's the final section of the thing. And then it closes with a phrase, blessed are all those who take refuge in him. And it is at this point that I want to switch gears from our from that hard-to-read foil to the hard-to-read handout. So let's go to the handout now. And you have all of this material, all the quotes about the background and things of this type in here already. We're not going to try to read through that like I classically try to do. I do want to point out, look on page 2, the one that's lettered E. This was a remark about the chains and fetters. This one resource points out when they say we're going to throw off his chains and his fetters. It is Satan's delusion, Genesis 3, 1 through 5, to represent design conditions of blessings as hostile restrictions holding mankind back from proper freedom. If you remember the passage in Genesis 3, God says, look, I got this wonderful tree of life for you to eat from. There's this other tree over here. Whatever you do, please don't touch this thing, because the day you do it, it's going to be destructive. You're going to die. Please don't eat this one. Don't do this one. This is the one, and all the other trees are great too, but here's the tree of life. Just please don't do this one. Don't do this one. And so when Satan comes up, the serpent comes up to tempt them, he leads with spinning it, says, has God restricted you? Has God told you not to eat from the tree? He casts what was a condition of blessing as a restriction on our freedom, right? And so in the moments that I'm struggling you know, with burdens or something, you know, or something's difficult with me about the Christian life, to the sense that I start seeing it as like too hard or too difficult or too restrictive or anything falls in that category. To that extent, I've caricatured it. I've misrepresented all of a sudden the freedoms that's in that. All of a sudden, I've spun it like a, you know, in the wrong direction because it ain't that way. It just ain't that way. You know, I've got to get back in the, and I've got somebody that sent a letter into the think tank, dear soul, some student from a college back east, torn up about all how hard it is in the Christian life and this and what happens if this happens and all these kinds of things. And do I have to do this to be saved? Do I have to, you know, give my life and do all these good works and all this kinds of stuff, you know? And, just no peace whatsoever. And I haven't had a chance to write them back yet, but, because it takes a long time to write these things back. But one of the things that I classically will say, well, okay, well, first thing to do is to reflect upon when Jesus said, suffer the little, let the little children come unto me, because of such is the kingdom. If you don't receive the kingdom as a little child, you shall in no wise enter therein, to use the old language, right? So you always go back to the model of how much oppressiveness does a child experience of Jesus when they're saved? How much lordship, salvation, do they, you know, how much labor, how much commitments, how much repentance, how much change of life do they, how much swearing off of this, or do they not just rejoice in the Lord? Do they just not live in the freedom and the refuge and the comfort? And that's the bottom line case as to whether how close our particular view of the Christian life is at any given moment to the real one. If to where it's not like somewhere in the third or fourth grade, if it's not like in that level of sweetness and freedom, then we've overdone it somehow. We've got to go back and rethink it. There are times where it's hard, you know, I mean, the apostle says, you're going to have hardship. You know, there are those moments. But by and large, the whole thing is not to be this oppressive thing. It's freedom, right? It's a freedom thing. We left the iron furnace of Egypt in that particular case, and walk in freedom before the Lord. So that freedom that we have in Christ and in the Spirit and the New Testament, things of this type, is so opposite from chains and fetters that if you start thinking in those terms, you sit there and say, something's wrong. I got to back up. I got to rethink this. Why, how did I get here? What am I perceiving that's messing me up here? Then let's go now over to page 4. And I'm not going to read these, but I'm just going to cover a little bit how these were used in the New Testament. So Psalm 2, the three big messianic psalms are Psalm 2, Psalm 22, of course, and Psalm 110. Psalm 2 is this one about my son, begotten, right? Psalm 110 is the one about Melchizedek, high priestly ministry of Christ, as being different than Levitical priesthood. It's a Melchizedekian priesthood. But I should mention, he also had Levitical blood in him. So I keep looking at these promises, like in Jeremiah 33, where it says, if you can break my covenant with the sun and moon and stars, then I'll break my covenant with David, and I'll break my covenant with Levi, that a person of their bloodline will not stand before me to offer. But the fact that Mary was kin to Elizabeth, who was of a priestly family, see? Unless it was some kind of weird in-law thing, which sort of didn't apply back in those days, then Mary had Levitical blood in her too. Not only was she from Judah, but the Messiah had to be just like Joseph was. But there was also some Levitical blood. Even though Hebrews said it wasn't recorded, you know, we didn't claim it. It said the Messiah came from Judah, not from Levi, because his lineage was traced from Judah. But the bloodline's the bloodline. So there's a possibility that some of those Levitical passages might actually also find fulfillment in Christ, in addition to the Melchizedekian priesthood. So Psalm 2 was my son, begottenness, ruler, messianic. Psalm 110 was the Melchizedekian priesthood. Right in the middle, of course, is Psalm 22, the crucifixion. My God, why has thou forsaken me? They pierced my hands and feet. They parted my garments. You know, that passage there, in which the psalmist described the crucifixion 700 years before it was invented. There was no form of death that matched the description of the psalmist for at least 400 years, at least 400 years before. So he predicted this stuff, and then wham, there it comes, God in the form of flesh. All right, so the New Testament passages which cite or allude to Psalm 2, that first one there is Acts 4. So Peter replies Psalm 2 when he's talking about how the Jewish leaders and the Roman leaders, not the common folk, but the leaders of both Jewish and non-Jewish worlds, they conspired to crucify Jesus. Okay, so why do the nations rage? Why do they plot against the Lord's anointed, against his king? He says that was fulfilled. That's a perfect example of that, or a fulfillment of that, in the death of Christ. The next verse under there on page 4 is Hebrews 1:1. Again, that's Hebrews saying, he says, to which of the angels, he's trying to prove that Christ is superior to angels. He says, to which of the angels did he ever call him his son? And I have begotten me. Right? He did. Sons, they are called sons of Elohim. The angels are called sons of Elohim, Bene Elohim, sons of God, in Job, a couple other places. But they're never called the sons of Yahweh, sons of the Lord. They are never called that. Okay. So thou art my son. That's Hebrews 1. Next page. The long passage there is from Acts 13. Paul's given a sermon to other Jews in a synagogue, Antioch, and he, you can see where it's bolded in the middle. He's talking about the promises of forgiveness and healing the nation of Israel. And God has fulfilled, verse 33 right there in the middle, God has fulfilled his promise to our children, and then he raised up Jesus, as it is also written in the second Psalm, thou art my son, I have forgotten thee. And he, and that next passage of under that Paul in Romans 1:1, I've already mentioned, was about, you know, declared to be the Son of God in power. So it was at the resurrection and ascension of Christ that God displayed the Son. They had an adoption ceremony among the elite families in the Roman world, the Greco-Roman world, that you could adopt a son, you could adopt somebody as a son during minority. So they could come in at, you know, you could adopt them at age 3 or 12 or something like this, and they would be legally a son, you know, and, you know, live in the household. You'd pay for their medical care and things of this type stuff. Right? But there were times that there was an official ceremony when you would do an adoption ceremony, and it would be a public thing. It would be a little bit like a bar mitzvah would be, you know, where you become a son of the law, but you would become a son of the household. And so he would officially be stating that this person can sign legal documents spending my money. You know, I mean, that level of inheritance is what that was about, to where you're a full-fledged adult adopted son with all the rights, privileges, and responsibilities thereof. And that's what the imagery is of him raising up. He was already a son, raised him up and stated before the whole world, says, this is who you have to do business with, not. He has committed all judgment to the hands of the Son. It's what Jesus told us about. Okay, and then the final page on the quotes, to page 6, you have another one from Hebrews 5:5, where again he mentions, this is in the Melchizedek, thou art my son, today I have begotten thee, just as he says in another passage, thou art a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. In other words, he put Psalm 2, Psalm 110 together and showed how Christ was both priest and king. See, that as the priest, he could carry all of our needs to the Lord. He could represent us. He could offer his own blood, the beauty of just the no payment required on our part. Just that, just freedom. That the lengths to which God went to bear all the costs, to do all the stuff that was required to get us little sheep into the shepherd's hand and out of the brambles, amazing. And so all these things converge. And those last three quotes are what tells us that this is a yet-to-be future. These are from the book of Revelation that's talking about in the end times that he will rule the nations with a rod of iron, vessels the potter are broken. Those images are still yet to be future, okay, from the book of Revelation standpoint. Now let me close on page 7 with four observations and applications of this as you reflect upon this. First of all, I should mention, it is odd that this Psalm is the second one in the Psalter. You know, this is a royal psalm. It started off with this gentle sort of wisdom kind of psalm, you know, And the next 3 to 4 are going to be about troubles of David and running from Absalom and just the normal rank and file trouble that we get ourselves into, you know, and God getting us out. You know, sinking in the mire, we cry, God sends a rope down, drags us out, cleans us up, you know, and we hopefully learn from this. But right before we get started, we have this thing about the Messianic King that somehow there's a confidence that God is going to win. And after all is said and done, we can throw all the locks away. All the locks away. And all we have to spend our time is rejoicing, getting to know one another, honoring, learning what God did in our lives, and just an incredible beauty there. That everything gets smoothed out. We don't have to worry about this, that, and the other. And there's, to use one song that said, there's always some crazy with an army or a knife to put the fear back in your life. And that's what we don't get once Psalm 2's done. When Psalm 2's done, we don't have that kind of scenario. Okay. So the first one are levels of description. This psalm definitely applies to David. The nations did. The second he was anointed king, the Philistines got together and attacked. They said, we've got to take him down quick before he gets all his power. Okay. It was also probably used as a coronation ceremony. It was also probably used every time there was a new king of David. Every time there was a Hezekiah, a Josiah that would come to the throne as a son of David, they would probably have a ceremony and they would go repeat this psalm, reminding the nations around them that this is God's ordained leader, and reminding the leader that his job was to reflect the Father's will. Okay, that was his job. The Jewish, early Jewish scribes referred the nations to Gog and Magog. So when they describe it in some of the Jewish literature, the rabbinical literature, this is a prophecy of the Messiah, and the nations that are raging are the Gog and Magog of Old Testament prophecy, which you probably have already studied with, you know, tribulation and millennium and things of this type. So they saw this as a prophecy of a future Messiah that's going to return and deal with the nations, as according with our traditional understanding of prophetic passages. And then the one that I put aside by is the personal sanctification. How often do I personally step over in the grumbling and the moaning and throwing off the fetters category? Twice a week, maybe? Twice a week, maybe there? Sometimes it's 10 seconds before God shares his chuckle with me. You know, sometimes it's 10 minutes before I realize, what am I doing over here again? Duh. Stupid. You know? And so there's an issue of do I... You know, am I moving from grumbling and groaning to silence, or which only postpones the problem, right? Doesn't really solve it. Or have I adjusted the issue and brought it to the Lord? I'm whining. Why am I whining today against you, Lord? Really, what's the issue here? I'm blind to this stuff. Can we work through this stuff? Can we pray? Can we have a sweet hour of prayer and talk about this? And I'll just vent and you correct me through the Spirit. Show me what's going on, you know, and make you honest. So there's an issue where we have to come face to face with God, that God is one, so powerful, knows everything about me, but he's also the only individual who is 100% sold out to the benefit and welfare of Glenn Miller. There's nobody else trustworthy like this one to care for you. Nobody. Someday we'll all be like that on the other side of new bodies and the grave. Right now, there's always someone that, some surprise that you do to yourself or that somebody else does to yourself. But there's a reality. When do I come in and I say, I need to rejoice? I need to get straight out here again. Then there's who takes refuge. At the end it says, who takes refuge? It says, blessed are those who take refuge. Right? Well, if you're already inside the kingdom, you don't need the refuge. You're already in refuge. There's no place to go. You're completely safe. So the call to refuge, is that to the wised up kings? The kings that said, you know, I could take refuge in there instead of just being, you know, groaning and grumbling and growling and always being fearful and trying to second guess all this stuff. Maybe I could just take refuge. Refuge is one of those great trust words. Refuge is one of those where you... Refuge. It's sanctuary. It's that big easy chair, plenty of shade and air conditioning and a hot day. Okay. Or how about subjects in the hostile kingdoms? These are the ones I think about. This is the little folk that are in the ancient Near East. When a kingdom was about to go to war to another, every citizen would sit there and make a decision based upon what they knew about whether they were about to lose everything they owned because the king was arrogant and prideful and was about to go up against a bigger thing. And so they would just do what smart folk do. They would say, let's go pull up the tent pegs, put them in the wagon, hitch up the camel, and we're going over to the other side, the side that I know is right, right? And so migrations were just constant in the ancient Near East as people would take refuge in a righteous kingdom, a fair kingdom, a just kingdom, a good kingdom that God had blessed. And so blessed are all those that refuge are invitations. I should also mention, by the way, I told you that the word for son was different. Remember, I have begotten you, my son. That's the Hebrew word ben. That's Israel. When it says to the nations, kiss the son, it's Aramaic. It's bar. See, that was the language they would have spoken, would have been bar, not ben. So Barabbas, son of the father. Barabbas, so Barjona, Simon Barjona. Bar is the word for son in Aramaic, not Hebrew. But it changes to show that he's addressing the other nations outside the world. Then third point is, why do we or anybody complain about the Lord's beautiful kingdom and authority? He uses his authority to serve us, even. This is the part that you struggle with constantly, is when you look at what God is about, when you look at like the most, some of the most exalted passages in the New Testament, like Ephesians, where you've got the great opening chapter where he orchestrates all these things, you know, just beautiful flow there. And he's got that section that says, and he does orchestrates all these things to the praise of the glory of his power. Some of you know that I didn't say that right. Or to the praise, the glory of his majesty, or of his holiness, or of his righteousness. That's not the word that's chosen. It's to the praise of the glory of his grace. That it might be known through the ages of it because of his kindness. God, if he wants something known, it's not about how shiny he is. It's about how far he will go to meet you where you are, where we are, as bad as we are, you know, three for a dozen volume discounts, you know, God will go there for us, right? That's what he's about. He wants to be known, not by his power, his judgment, but by his grace, by his goodness, his kindness, his approachability, and we don't get it. We just don't get it enough that that's what God is about. There's that passage where Jesus is describing the Father, and he's talking, it's a passage on servanthood. He's talking about being faithful servants. And remember in the ancient Near Eastern world, you had a monarchical head of the household, so to speak. And in a wealthy household, you'd have several layers of servants. And servants could have servants. Servants weren't like the slaves of the New World. They were more like military, where you worked for like 3 to 5 years in this position, and then you got a scholarship, you know, got your education point for it. But they would pay for their own. They would go into business with the owners and all this kind of stuff. A completely different kind of world. If you want to know more about it, go to the Christian think tank and read the article in the Old from New Testament slavery. But the servants would go out and serve. And Jesus told this story. He says, what shall be done for the servant that serves his master's will faithfully and loyally and in love, out of love for the master? When he comes in from the day's labor, the master himself will sit them at his table. Tables were organized by size and height, by the way, for social status in the rich families, right? Will sit him at his table. The master, the monarch, the ruler, will take off his clothes and put on a servant's clothes and go serve them as waiters at the table. That is so opposite of what every expectation of a God was. See, that was unthinkable. To think of God stooping that low to honor those that honored him, right? And that's that reciprocity. That's the beauty of grace, that unexpectedness. And so Jesus told that probably a year and a half before he did the foot washing at the Last Supper. So at the Last Supper, he's made the point. He says, okay, you finally got it. I'm the Lord and I'm your teacher and Lord. You call me teacher and Lord, and you're right. You finally got that, okay? Now let me show you what that means, what authority and power and knowledge is about. And it's at that point he sets off his garment, drapes himself with a towel of the foot washing, the lowest of the low servant menial task, and washes the feet of the disciples. He says, this is what God is about. This is what grace is like. It doesn't matter the power you have. It doesn't matter. If you've got that much power, you're not egocentric. You're not arrogant. You don't need that stuff anymore. Okay, you're about using that to grow flowers and hearts and smiles and hugs and healing and redemption. That's what you're about. Okay, so why would we complain about that kind of authority in our lives when he just wants to use it for our benefit and our growth into his image? And finally, the last point, the Lord's commitment. There's two levels of commitment. Excuse me. is the Lord's commitment to the Son's ministry. So the Father in this psalm is dead set on making sure that the Messiah rules and doesn't have any trouble and gets everything he wants and needs. Ask, I'll give you everything. I'm here, I've set up my authority, we're going to do it this way, right? Backs him up. The Son's commitment is to the Father's interest. The Son is the vice regent, rules in place of the Son, represents his interest, represents his values, okay? That heart is one, is of unquestioning obedience. He just loves the Father, wants to do what he wants to do. And the reason I put this in there is that one of the things that I'm slowly realizing 40 years into my walk with the Lord is that he has grown in me the heart of the Father. So I understand now my heart is filled with compassion and pity and aggressiveness and the things that the Father did in sending the Son. That now comes natural to me. That's a fruit of the Spirit that takes a long time, and I'm only part way there. But what I see not there where it needs to be is the heart of the Son. The heart of the Son that obeys without question, without hesitation, no betrayal, no disloyalty, no slacking off, no nothing. That just natural obedience, naturally representing is the thing that still escapes. I aspire to that, but I realize that that's the harder part. That's the harder part is to grow that obedience. Some of it comes through difficulty. Some of it comes through just the flow of the Spirit. But here was the Son, the model of the Son that just came, I came to do your will, Father. End of statement, not mine, but yours. Did he struggle with it? Of course. Great drops of blood. No question it was a struggle. But was there any hesitation?
No.
Some he did for us. Some he was sitting there looking at the little glen, the little sheep caught out in the brambles, crying and bleating, can't get free. And every time he tries to help himself, he cuts himself a little deeper. Parts of that, but parts of the Father says, I'm not going to let this go to waste. Father, these are yours. You gave them to me. I'm not going to let one of them be lost. So that heart of the Son, when we look at the relationship of the Son and the Father's and those interactions of the passages like this, it's helpful sometimes to look at both sides. And say, Lord, I appreciate what this happened. I need now to grow more into be conformed to the image of Christ. I need to be more obedient in this fruitfulness and fulfilling your will in where we go. So let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for your immense love. We just could never thank you enough for this freedom of forgiveness. Just being able to live in the sunshine with you and rest and refuge and sanctuary and safety and encouragement, comfort. Of your presence, your constant activity in our lives. And I just pray that you would take this message to us, Lord, today, that you are sufficient, that you are interested in our welfare, that you are in pursuit of reconciliation. It's your highest value of this grace. May our hearts melt before you because of this, because of this psalm, of this call to rejoice with trembling, with respect. And may we be different because of this time we spend here together. Bless these precious folk, Lord, with your word and closer walk and joy and celebration and victory over things they face. And help us all just get to know you better and to love you more. We ask this for your Son's sake. Amen.